Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. Today we have with me Mike Weinstock, and he's going to kick off this kind of series of talks that I plan on having here in the future, talking about different parts of documentation and malpractice and things like that. And he's the author of the Bounce Back series. And really, before I go into too much, I want Mike to introduce himself. Can you go ahead, Mike?
So I'm the Associate Program Director at the ADINA Emergency Medicine Residency here in Ohio. I'm also a Professor of Emergency Medicine Adjunct at The Ohio State University, Wexner Center of Excellence, and then the Editor-in-Chief for Urgent Care RAP, the Risk Management Section Editor for MRAP, as well as a few other things. And in addition to that, the author of the Bounce Back series. And it's very exciting. We're working on our fourth Bounce Back book now, which is a Bounce Back's critical care book with Scott Weingart and Kevin Clower. So a lot of stuff hopefully we can talk about today.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I'm hoping that maybe I can get Kevin on later, but I didn't even realize you're doing that with Kevin and Scott. That sounds really, really fascinating. You may have to give us a little sneak peek here in a little bit on some of that.
We can do that.
So let's talk about first what I had you on here for. And that was, I mean, you can talk about so many different things, but something I feel like is so important and is worth making this the first podcast in this series about is the MDM, the medical decision-making portion of the chart. Because at least in my shop, not everyone's doing this yet. I don't know, maybe you guys have this already set up where you're at. You're at The Ohio State, which I love. Everyone always says The Ohio State.
It's The Ohio State. Not just Ohio State.
So I guess the first part is, what is the MDM? What does that actually mean?
Well, I'm glad that you asked me that question because the MDM is such a frequently confused aspect of the chart. And what I see so frequently is people just restating their history of present illness in the medical decision-making. Like, this is a 50-year-old man with substernal chest pain radiating to the shoulders with shortness of breath and diaphoresis. And I'm like, well, didn't you just say that already in your history of present illness? And it doesn't have what the title is, which is the actual decision making. I like to think of the MDM as a hard stop. When you get to that MDM, what I tell people is to write down your actual decision making process, how you arrived at the diagnosis that you came up with, and how you excluded those other serious life-threatening diagnoses, how you determined that those were not occurring. And if you use it as a hard stop, in other words, at the completion of your documentation, say to yourself, man, I see what I wrote. If I can't even convince myself that what I think is going on is actually going on or something else isn't going on, well, there's no way I'm going to be able to convince a spouse, a parent, a child, a jury, that this thing is happening. If you can stop yourself at that time and re-examine contemporaneously before the patient leaves the emergency department, we have an incredible potential to improve patient safety.
I really like the way that you said that because it is a hard stop. And I think like most of the time when I do charts, I try and make sure the chart's finished before the patient leaves and that the last part is actually the dispo part. And then I'm basically done with the chart. That's what happens most of the time. And my MDM sometimes gets basically embedded in the progress section. That's basically because of how our charts are set up. But I use that as right off the bat, I basically put a beginning MDM. And maybe the patient is pretty sick and I can't make up my final decision yet. This may not have been a quick in-out sore throat. I already have my test back. This is what it is. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to make sure that I'm at least critically thinking at this point, what do I need to consider? And there have been times, and I'm sure you've done the same thing, Mike, where you stop for a second and you say, wait a second, did I consider, let's go back to that chest pain. Did I consider that maybe this isn't just reflux? Because now I'm putting in their diaphoretic, they've got pain radiating to all these different places. And no, this doesn't sound like I can just call it reflux. I need to make sure I'm explaining why. You know, did they just get out of a chili contest or something like that? I don't know. But, you know, explaining why my reasoning is this way and making sure I'm not missing the important things. Like, did I explain why I don't think this is dissection? Did I explain how my EKG and serial troponins were all okay? What is it that I made sure to specify that rules out the other life threats? And I think that's an important part of making sure that phrasing and that wording is there to support that.
You bring up a really important point, and that is the contemporaneous documentation. In other words, before the patient leaves the emergency department, and especially with a critical patient, I will oftentimes see that critical patient, do my history, do my physical documentation, and then put a note in and date and timestamp it. So the chart will reflect what I'm thinking at that time. And with a truly critical patient where there's multiple different pathways, I'll have multiple different short sections in the medical decision making or the progress notes section, whichever section you want to put it in is fine, that reflect what I'm thinking at the time. So when you think about something like, I mean, we'll just take the O.J. Simpson trial, you know, that does the gloves fit moment when they had O.J. try on the gloves and they were too small. You know, you like to think if you're resting your entire case on one thing, it better be a really, really firm type of data, a firm type of finding that enables you to make your decision. So I'm totally happy to send home a 50-year-old with pain, ongoing chest pain. I'm happy to send them home, but I want to view my medical decision-making as my argument. It's like my closing argument. Now, not a closing argument in a medical legal case, but if you think in any trial, when you say something like, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the reason I think this is musculoskeletal and not ischemic heart disease that's going to kill this patient is because, and then you go back to plus reproducible chest wall pain. To me, that's not good enough. If I'm using that as my closing argument, why not put something in the medical decision-making note and your physical exam, something like when I palpate the left lower sternal border and point tenderness, the patient winces in pain and yells out, ouch, that hurts, or withdraws from pain, or any one of a number of things that really demonstrates the fact that that pain is musculoskeletal, and that's what's causing it. Sort of in the same way, you know, I'm happy with an abdominal exam to write something like soft and non-tender when you're examining a patient who has an ankle sprain. Now, frankly, I don't usually do abdominal exams in ankle sprain patients, but that being said, soft and non-tender is just fine with the ankle sprain. If you have a patient with right lower quadrant abdominal pain, and their question they're asking when they present to the ED is, do I have appendicitis? Well, soft and non-tender is not good enough. I want something like the abdomen is normal to inspection. I don't see any surgical scars, evidence of zoster. The patient has pain, which is moderate in severity when I palpate at McBurney's point, but there's no rigidity, rebound, or guarding, negative rostering sign. I mean, you want to have a really focused argument that you have in the chart. And medical decision-making section is the perfect place to put that argument.
I've noticed before, at least for me, when I do some of the speaking of the abdominal exam, but also in general, that I will sometimes put additional exam findings. I may not necessarily put in the physical, but that's because I'm actually going into a little more depth behind it. So for example, let's say we're using that abdominal pain patient. I'm going to put in the negative Robzings, negative McBurney's, no Murphy's tenderness, no psoas or obturator sign, all those types of things. But then I'll explain like the pain more specifically is located to the left lower quadrant, but it is more laterally. There is no evidence of rebound or guarding. All this is consistent with whatever the case may be. But by adding in just a tiny bit more detail, because the physical exam, it's hard to put in everything you want sometimes, depending on your charting system, without going overboard. And a lot of times it gets missed in all the hubbub. How many times do we gloss over the physical exam stuff when we're just trying to find that pertinent positive? And it's hard to find because it's buried in all the facts of the physical exam. Sometimes it's worth restating a little bit of that physical, the key parts that you want, and maybe delve into a little more. Like when I did push over that area, they reported pain. They did not appear to be in any distress, and they were still eating their bag of Cheetos when I was talking to them.
Right, exactly. Well, you're saying something really important is that oftentimes during the course of our evaluation, we get unexpected findings. And what we want to do is avoid falling prey to some of those biases, some of those cognitive dispositions to respond that Pat Crosskerry, the Canadian emergency physician who described these initially, we want to make sure we don't have anchoring bias where we anchor onto a finding or a diagnosis too early in the evaluation. And then we don't let subsequently obtained superior data interfere with what we already know to be going on when we first see the patient. So I'll give an example of that. You have a patient who has some leg pain. you think maybe it's a DVT. So you ask them, you know, do you have any shortness of breath or chest pain? Check them for PE. Maybe you ask them, do you have any fever or any dizziness or vomiting? You're thinking about something like unusual, like necrotizing fasciitis that's in your history. Then you get to your exam and you go down there and examine the leg and find that it's cold and blue. Well, all of a sudden, that simple, yeah, just get a Doppler. If it's positive, they get some Lovenox and, you know, Xarelto. And if it's, or you know, they would just get some anticoagulation. And, you know, if it's negative, they're just going home. All of a sudden, your evaluation and your management is totally thrown on its head because of that finding. That's something that frequently happens with laboratory findings, other test findings, when we get an unexpected finding. So I do the exact same thing that you do. I will put those additional findings in the medical decision-making note. To me, it seems like it reads more smoothly, like a outside observer, when they're looking at my evaluation as reflected in my documentation, they can see what I was doing at the time and they can follow it through chronologically. It's not a mistake to put it in the physical exam, but it is a little bit weird when a patient is there for 5 hours and you put the finding in the physical exam, you know, the leg is cold and blue or whatever, and 5 hours later is when you call the vascular surgeon. So I do exactly like you do. I put that in medical decision making and I date and time it.
And that's so important now that you mentioned this twice, the time stamping side of it. I've actually had this come up before with discussions when, like, for example, peer review, whatever the case may be, and people start looking at your timeline. And that's what they want to do. If you put all your MDM and all of your progress into one unlabeled section, that becomes a huge cluster because then you don't really have any defense for yourself. Or what about that consultant who never calls you back? You know, I ran into this not that long ago. We had someone who was on call and I made sure to document the 3 different times we tried calling. They never responded. Luckily, the issue had resolved by then. But at the same time, I can go back to my charting and say, if you looked, we tried 3 different times to call the specialist on call. We were never able to get a hold of that person. And it doesn't look like you said, well, I tried to call them and it looks like it only was called once and they never answered, or I didn't document that I called 3 different times over the course of an hour and a half. It was, oh, we called 3 times in a row and they didn't answer. So those little things like that, that timestamp can make or break you really if you're not really thinking about things clearly. And just like you said, the vascular surgeon, that's an important point. One other thing that you mentioned here, I think is worth bringing up, that anchor bias. And we see this all the time, right? Because, for example, the most common is the triage note, where the triage note, and I don't know, maybe you have excellent triage and nothing ever gets missed ever, but I don't always have that. And
right. Yeah. So never gets missed. Right. Exactly.
There was a Gomer blog post. I may have to add this in the show notes. I've never done a Gomer blog post as a show notes before, but it's a perfect one where it's talking about the triage nurse rolls the die and it's 1 through 6. Well, there's only 5 ESI levels. So if she rolls a 6, she'll keep rolling again and again and again until they get number 1 through 5. So the chest pains in L5, but the stubbed toes in L1 and, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
But really that anchor bias of that, well, they came in and they just said that they had a cough. And yeah, they said they had a little bit of chest pain and then they get back to the fast track side and sure enough, you know, someone's thinking and they said, we should probably go ahead and get an EKG on this. What was an L4 upper respiratory complaint now ends up being a STEMI. And so that anchor bias can so lead you astray. And I've actually seen pretty much that exact scenario before. And it was as simple as that. The person said, well, but they have a cough. You can have all sorts of findings with STEMI. So I guess add that to the list, that cough and chest pain, sometimes not good enough. You know, it's those little things like that. We have to be careful about what we're seeing and what's being documented and making sure that we're also repeating our own history and physical, even if the student has done it, the nurse has done it, you know, the tech who first brings the patient back in the room. So many people ask questions and we just hope that basically we're going to get this right. And I know sometimes patients get annoyed by this. And actually one of my medical directors said it best. And he said that he'll tell patients, yeah, I'm going to ask you some of the same questions and hopefully you have the same answers. You know, it's kind of one of those things. It's okay if we ask this a couple of times over.
We incorporated into our triage process a question. And it was, what's the main thing that concerns you today? Patients, in all fairness to them, you know, they're not the historian. We're the historian. So we say, patient is a bad historian. That's exactly wrong. That's our job. And look, you know, I totally get it. And I'm totally frustrated when a patient is not able to give a cognizant history. But in all fairness to them, they might be hurting, they might be altered because of substances or brain mass or bleed or Alzheimer's or a pediatric patient that you can't get a great history from. So asking them, what's your main concern, can really, really help us to focus in. It's one of the biggest medical legal mistakes that happens is that the provider does not address the chief complaint as recorded by the nurse or the tech or whoever's recording the chief complaint. And the second one, and this might not be as much medical legal, but it's still super important, you know, reassurance of the patient that we've heard their complaint and that we're addressing their main concern is a huge part of healing. So missing that opportunity with the 23-year-old woman who is there with the one day of cough, who's concerned about lung cancer because her aunt died with the exact same symptoms. And of course, you and I and the listener is thinking, well, of course, the like 6 months of cough with weight loss after, you know, 60 pack years of smoking was a little different than what you had. However, we can say we're not missing any life-threatening problem with this 23-year-old. However, we do have a chance to heal. And reassurance is a big part about that. And understanding their main concern is the quintessential aspect that we need to understand before we can start healing.
Such an important point. Actually, this can also tie in some ways with the shared decision-making process, because maybe that person is coming in for something else, or let's just tie this in kind of with everything that's going on. Maybe there's that person that you decide you don't want to do all the tests with, or maybe you find it not appropriate. Maybe that chest or abdominal pain patient, or even that cough patient. Maybe you, that was their main concern. You said, hey, I mean, we can do this, but let's not do all the testing I would for the big cancer workup, but let's just talk about a few different things. And by the time you talk to them, if you address their issues, which one of the main things I do a lot of times is I make sure to help summarize what they've told me and what I've seen. And this is really great when you have a student, because I find this happens all the time when I have a student around, especially. I say, okay, I want to make sure we summarize so we're all on the same point here. This is what you came in for. This was your concern. This is what you told me about. This is what we've seen. Am I missing anything? And that can be such a simple, quick recap. You do that in a few seconds and you've got everything you need. But I feel like shared decision making is such an important part of modern healthcare. And you're going to run across those patients that old farmer who just says, I don't care, just tell me what you think and fix me up here, doc. You know, that sometimes happens. But what do you think about shared decision making when it comes to the MDM, and how do you document that, and how do you make sure that you are really doing what's best for your patient on whether or not to test for certain things, and why you all decided that maybe the chest pain patient didn't need the big cardiac workup. Maybe I decide I want to do a, you know, grasshopper and some antacids to treat their pain. And guess what? It got better and they feel great and they want to go home now. You know, how do we cover all that?
That shared decision-making is this term that people are throwing around. But the most important thing to understand about shared decision-making is that it needs to be a decision between two reasonable alternative pathways. So I'll give you an example of that is you can't really look at the 80-year-old with a cough productive of green sputum, a temperature of 104, and a blood pressure of 60, and saying, hey, do you want a Z-Pak or do you want to be admitted? You know, those aren't two reasonable alternative pathways. On the other hand, I'll give you an example that I use a lot. There was a study by a guy named Bickel in the Journal of the American College of Surgery, and he looked at patients who have a ruptured appendix relative to the time of onset of their symptoms. And he found that less than 2% of patients will have a ruptured appendix within 36 hours after onset of symptoms. So if you have, just for example, the patient comes in and they're at 12 hours and they have a concerning story, but based on your exam, it's not diagnostic. It's concerning enough that you would go further with additional testing, for example, ultrasound or CAT scan, or maybe even directly to surgery, although that doesn't happen these days as much. But it's a concerning story. And you say to that patient, let's do this. They say, well, because of financial reasons, I don't want to CAT a CAT scan. Or as I'm sure you and I have had many times in the past, we've heard, well, you know, I have to let my dog out or whatever, you know. So the patient decides at the 12-hour mark to go home. Well, to me, that seems unreasonable as a clinician. I don't want to hassle with them coming back, have to do repeated examination and evaluation. I don't know if they're going to come back. It seems high risk. They're going to sign the AMA form. It's a lot of extra hassle on my part. But for them, that might be a reasonable alternative pathway. And the fact is, based on the data, at 12 hours, it is. Because you know what? They can come back at 8 to 12 hours if they have worse pain or fever, or if their pain hasn't completely 100% resolved, and they would be totally fine because the risk of the appendix rupturing at 24 hours is close, not exactly, but close to zero. So that's a good example of using shared decision-making. The sepsis patient, I don't know about you, but I'm admitting that patient 100% of the time.
completely. Now, with that, that's a very important point, is because we do use the word shared decision-making a lot, and really it's sometimes hard to go through that, and that's why I usually try and specify, at least in my MDM, that when I'm using shared decision-making, let's go back to that abdominal pain patient that you gave. I'm going to explain that here's what we can do. We can do more testing now. You could potentially decide to wait. You could even potentially follow up with your PCP, especially let's say the pain goes away. I still want you to follow up because that's a little concerning. In this specific instance, also ties in with the plan for follow-up care and disposition and stuff like that, which I think is very important to also include on there, especially your return instructions. So I make sure I always kind of specify a certain part of my chart about what instructions I gave them, how I told them to follow up, making sure to get timelines and guidelines through about this is what I need you to do and this is how I need you to follow up. But that's a very important point that you mentioned, where you have a patient that you say is maybe a lower risk, or maybe someone you can't really determine their risk yet because it's still too early in their illness. And how many times do we see the kid who's just been febrile for the last 2 hours? Looks fine, looks great, but this is someone who can still be very sick, that, you know, 10-month-old may end up having sepsis, but can't really tell yet. I mean, the kid's only been sick for a couple hours, so that documentation is very important about, well, we discussed with the parents and they decide they want to forego more testing at this time. We talked about the risk, benefits, and potential complications of such. They agreed to such risk and potential complications with the understanding of the need for follow-up, including here. We also discussed warning signs and symptoms that would require immediate return to this ED versus saying like they would return with their PCP if the fever just kept ongoing, but they were otherwise fine. Well, no, if your kid starts having new symptoms and these are the ones I want you to watch for because this is what I'm most worried about. And then I also make sure to document about the fact that they understood that and that they agree with this plan, because it's very important. But some patients, and sometimes this is really hard depending on the type of patient, where you can make sure they understand. But I think it's so important to say that we discuss this plan in detail, they verbalize understanding, and they agree with this plan. Because there are definitely patients where sometimes they may say, I don't necessarily agree with this plan. Okay, then let's figure out what we can agree to. And maybe this is one of those times of maybe the chest pain patient who says, well, I know I'm all better now. I know that grasshopper helped me out and I feel wonderful. And yeah, I could probably go home, but I just had a brother who died of a heart attack and I just feel better if I had a little more of a workup after that. Okay, that seems very reasonable. Let's talk to the hospitalist or whoever's going to admit that patient. Let's see what they think. And if I at least explain the scenario, hopefully they'll understand, they'll agree with this plan. Those are two different kind of things. And I feel like it's all important to tie in with that same MDM, that this is the type of decision we're making.
So for the last 20 years, regarding chest pain, I've told patients after a negative emergency department evaluation that you still need to be admitted because of the risk of arrhythmia, of sudden death, and sending you home is too risky. What I've come to understand, and a lot of it is based on a study that I published just 2 years ago in JAMA Internal Medicine, looking at patients, almost 50,000 patients who had presented with chest pain, but had a non-ischemic and interpretable EKG, non-concerning vital signs, and 2 negative troponin tests. And when we looked at those patients, we teased that down to 7,266 patients, and we looked at the patients that had one of 4 things, what we defined as a CRACE outcome or a clinically relevant adverse cardiac event. So sort of distinguished from the MACE outcome in the heart study and things where they looked at things like revascularization. So we looked at some serious problems such as a life-threatening arrhythmia we looked at patients who had a STEMI, who had arrest, cardiac or respiratory, or death. So when we looked at those four things, we were astounded to find over 7,000 patients. There were four patients who had one of these adverse outcomes. One was from a non-cardiac cause. One was iatrogenic because of nitro they received in the hospital, had a bradysystolic arrest requiring chest compressions. And two were bad events that occurred during hospital procedures. Stress test was the main cause of those. So when I think back to my process, the way that I have managed patients for the last 20 years, and again, telling them they need to be admitted, well, I was probably saying it's too risky, but probably it was too risky for me and not necessarily too risky for them. And when I think back to an alternative pathway, again, which we can engage in with shared decision-making by saying, let's have a expedited outpatient evaluation where we're not finishing your ED evaluation saying everything's fine, just that your evaluation can be safely continued as an outpatient. When we do that, that is a, again, is a reasonable alternative pathway. And that's a perfect example for shared decision-making as defined in a lot of ways by Eric Hess from Mayo Clinic, one of the study researchers on my new chest pain study. And he's done tons of work with shared decision-making, especially in regards to chest pain. And those are very comparable to the findings that he had also.
So important, and you threw out so many things all at once, but it's all great content because that's exactly what we need to sometimes consider. Who's this more risky for? Is it more risky for the patient? Is it more risky for us? And I think we probably all have those people that we work with, that those providers say, I'm not sending any chest pain home. I'm not sending any name whatever thing, PE home, DVT home, whatever the case is. I'm not going to send any of these patients home. They're too high risk. Is it really too high risk? Is that what the evidence shows? Or is that what you feel most comfortable medical legally? Because in your case, the four patients you mentioned, one was non-cardiac, so not necessarily related to what your major concern was. So let's talk about the other three there. All three are basically things that were associated with potentially the hospital stay versus other event. Would it have been safer to go home? That's almost the thing we got to keep in mind is really what's our risk benefit there. And we talk about that for other diagnoses, such as using the PE workup. When we anticoagulate someone for the subsegmental PE, is that really the best thing for them? Or are they going to have a negative outcome because we went down the whole workup? Maybe some of these are okay to miss. And it's kind of hard to explain that sometimes to patients. You have to really find the right words, and especially for that particular person. But to say, really, in the grand scheme of things, this is what we hope. And they may be that small percentage of people who may have that negative outcome. And so I make sure to explain to everyone when I am dispositioning them home for, let's say, that chest pain, just to keep on topic with this. I use the heart score most of the time. I'll have to talk about your stuff more in the future too, but let's talk about this roughly 2% risk. There's a 2% risk that something bad happened to you, and that can happen to you in the next 6 weeks. And I can't tell you if it's going to be you, if it's going to be someone else. And when you are honest with patients and you can document that conversation with them and everything, it's really that patient themselves, because they don't care about how you document. They care about what you tell them. And when I show them that I really do care about them and this is my information I want to give them, it changes. And most patients are willing to say, yeah, I understand that and that's okay. And you'll find the ones who say, nope, this is too high risk for me still. That 2% is still too much for me. And that's fine. We'll work out a plan. But those are two very different types of scenarios. And I feel like it's all part, getting back on conversation, this all ties into our MDM. It really does, because that's what's going to help you document that stuff. Just because you had that conversation is usually not enough to tie everything in.
Just putting it by extension into the aftercare instructions isn't enough either. So saying something in your medical decision-making, we discussed the different pathways. We discussed why the patient would need to return and the patient agrees with this plan and they seem reliable, for example. So yeah, putting that part in the medical decision-making is so important because it's been shown that the aftercare instructions are not really legally protective. You give someone like a 20-page novella of aftercare instructions, return if like there's a solar eclipse, return if like, the dinosaurs come back. Well, that's not really going to help you in a courtroom if you've made a misdiagnosis.
Yeah, and I mean, we all talk about the follow-up with PCP, return for new or worsening symptoms. That is a catch-all type of phrase, but that's why it matters more what you actually tell the patient. Exactly like you said. I'm so glad you put that out there.
Well, let me give you just a couple of real quick scenarios that I found with the medical legal review that I have done as far as simple, like low-hanging fruit type of lessons to avoid, most importantly, a misdiagnosis because of patient safety, but also, I mean, of course, what we think about sometimes too is avoiding some sort of lawsuit. I'll just, if it's okay with you, we could go through like a top 10 list of ways to more appropriately document that will help to decrease the risk of misdiagnosis and lawsuits. What do you think?
Sounds great. Let's do it.
Top 10 list, number 10, address the nursing chief complaint in your note. It is understandable that the patient tells their story so many times before we actually see the patient that they told their chief complaint to the person registering their insurance information, but that person was, according to them, a representative of the healthcare system. Number 9, see the forest for the trees. Use the history of present illness to explore the present illness. What I see so frequently on charts is this huge history of present illness, but almost all of that is a restatement of the past medical history. It's fine to put that in your HPI, but make sure you also include the history of present illness. Now, you could use the old car mnemonic or code ears, complaint onset duration, etc., but use something to gather the appropriate data on which to make your decision. If you don't have the appropriate data, there's no way you're going to be able to come up with a accurate diagnosis.
Can I mention something there real quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned a very important point. Now, I do this with charts. Let's say you have someone who has a long past medical history that you really need to mention because it ties in with this case, especially bounce back patients. I do this a lot. Paragraph number 1 is about this is who's presenting, this was their recent stay, this was some of their pertinent findings, this is the plan for their treatment and follow-up, and that's paragraph number 1. For paragraph number 2, on today's visit, patient states, and now we go into the true HPI, what's the history of the present illness, because now it's something that's divided out and people can look at and say, oh, so this is all what they came for last time, oh, this is what they're coming in for now.
Right, because that past history is important, but exactly like you said, I mean, the present illness is what's going on currently, sometimes in the context of what happened in the past. Number 8 of the top 10 list, document a neuro exam. And I'll tell you, it is astounding to me that if you have respiratory symptoms, we all listen to the lungs. If you have abdominal pain, I mean, of course, we're going to examine the abdomen. But isn't it amazing that probably a third of the time, the patients that we see in the emergency department have things like headache, numbness, confusion, weakness, fatigue, incontinence, retention, slurred speech, facial droop. I mean, I could keep going on and on, but it's astounding to me that when you have a neuro complaint, we do not as reliably document a neuro exam. Number 7, use a voice-activated macro, only if it's true. It's a lot easier for us to have a macro that's basic that we can expand upon than a macro that's very extensive we need to whittle down. So I'll give you an example of that also, the eye exam. Why put in there pupils equally round and reactive to light and accommodation when we know that no one's checking accommodation? There's a lot of different words for putting that on the chart if you haven't done it. And one of those words is lying. Now, I use that word sort of cavalierly because I'm sure I have put things on my charts that I haven't done. I mean, I guess probably I might try not to, of course. But why would you put that as part of a macro when you could put something more basic, especially when typically we're recording an eye exam for maybe billing reasons or something else on a patient who has, just for example, abdominal pain? Now, sometimes that can be helpful to us also, but why not have the most basic part that we can add on to? Number 6, provide a specific description of the encounter. So we talked before, and I like this example, why not, if we're hanging our hat on the fact that the patient has musculoskeletal chest wall pain, why not put in that the patient does get facial wincing or they ball up their left fist and try to smack us across the jaw when we're pressing at the, as we said before, left lower sternal border. So making sure that we provide an adequate description of what's going on is super, super, super important. And an extension of that might be again, a child that we're evaluating for some sort of serious illness, sepsis, headache, meningitis, why put alert and oriented times three in a two-year-old when you could put something like the child is running down the hall, screaming and laughing, being chased by their parent? To me, that's a way, a Hemingway-esque, you know, way to paint a picture of exactly what's going on. Number five, and we've talked about this, so we won't really talk about it more now, but that MDM, and I just want to emphasize that using that as a hard stop to ask ourselves that question, if we can't even convince ourselves, how can we convince a family member or a jury as to what is going on or what is not going on with that patient? Number four, performing a repeat abdominal exam on all abdominal pain patients and documenting that in the medical decision-making note. Number three, this is a approach, I call it the three R's. It's revisit, record, and recruit. In other words, going back, reassessing the patient, recording, again, as the chart, as well as the medical decision-making, and then recruiting. In other words, family members, maybe even a specialist to try to get extra help. This is a open book test. We're not being graded on what we remember. We're being graded on our street smarts as far as making an appropriate and timely diagnosis on patients. Number two, for patients leaving against medical advice, making sure that we document capacity. I have a case that's going to be in the new Bounce Backs critical care book of a patient who had a terribly devastating process occurring. The patient bounced back and died within 15 minutes of their return visit. The first visit where he was seen was discharged against medical advice, but they never put anything about capacity. And if the patient was actually able to make his own decision about leaving. And then finally, on the top 10 list, and these are sage words that, well, okay, you can be the judge of that, right? I would say this, do not practice defensive medicine, but document in a way that is defensible. So there you go. There's the top 10 list.
I love all of them, but I especially love number one, because that is so important. We talked about how, are you really doing it for the patient or are you doing it for yourself? And I think that's such a good point to hit on as the final point. But Mike, do you have anything else that you would like to add?
Please, every listener, go get yourself a drink or something, because, you know, listening to me for this long, you know, probably there is some anxiety or chest pain you're having also at this time.
And if so, go to the ED, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Dial 911.
But yeah, with all that, I really appreciate having you on, Mike. I feel like this is something we could probably do again and talk more on, expand. We didn't even get to talk about some of the fun stuff, some of the cases you've done. We hit little bits of each, but I think we're going to have you back on it sometime.
I look forward to doing it again sometime.
So without further ado,
until next time, provide total care everywhere.
Thank you for downloading another episode of Total EM. We want to thank our bandwidth sponsor, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this show. You can also see them on our website, but we also have included links to their website, funnyrx.com. Again, thank you, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this episode.